Thanks, Lee, and thanks everyone for having Jenny and me back with you again. To talk about shepherds today seems a bit like bringing coals to Newcastle, because it's been evident to us over the several times that we've met with you that this is a very shepherding community. You care for each other, you look for out for each other, and you emulate what the Good Shepherd is all about. So why am I looking at the shepherd theme today? It comes up on the calendar every fourth Sunday after Easter. And many churches around us will be focusing on the theme of the Good Shepherd today. And as the Easter season continues on, nearly all the way to Pentecost, I thought it might be good to ask, what light does the resurrection of Christ throw on what John thinks Jesus meant when he said, "I am the Good Shepherd"? We're going to the Gospel of John to seek some answers. And while I've spoken on this text a few times over the years, I always like to come at it fresh. To break the ground, I usually review some commentaries and translations to find what direction the Spirit might be leading. But this time I thought, why not play around with some AI? Students are using it to write their stories and their essays. Engineers are employing AI to solve complex problems. Journalists are resorting to it to meet deadlines for their editors. Surely it can help me find a fresh and meaningful angle on how John's Good Shepherd can speak to the contemporary Australian scene. I limit things up a bit by inviting my cyber robot to express our text in various genres, a Shakespearean sonnet, a Japanese haiku, after the fashion of a Banjo Paterson Bush ballad, even converted to the lyrics in the style of a punk rock rap. Although adept at each of these challenges, AI seemed keen to hang on to that traditional picture of the tall and erect Caucasian figure of Jesus, fair-faced, neatly coiffed, well-laundered and pressed robe, and shouldering a fluffy white lamb while gazing serenely ahead. Not to be outdone, I told AI to write it in strine. I think the Spirit must have been speaking in the same way to Lee as to me. And I think Lee's version is far superior. But I'll tell you what it did with strine. It took all the other requests that I'd made and sort of combined it all together. So you got a bit of Shakespeare and a bit of Banjo Paterson and a bit of punk rock all mixed in. "Oi, listen up, mate. I got a yarn to spin about a bloke called the Good Shepherd. He's a top win. He's got his sheep sorted. He knows them by name, and they follow him round without hint of shame. He opens up the gate, they hear his voice, and they all follow him as if by choice. The others they ignore, they don't know their sound, but the Good Shepherd, he's always around. And watch out for them dodgy blokes at night. The ones who want to pinch the sheep give them a fright. But the Good Shepherd, he won't let that fly. He'll fight them off and make sure his sheep don't die. Because he's the one who'll lay down his life for his flock. He's the one who'll fight for them around the clock. He's the one who'll keep them safe from harm and wrong. He's the one who'll lead them home where they belong. So let's all follow the Good Shepherd. Don't you worry. He'll lead us to green pastures in no big hurry. And we'll be with him always, never alone, because the Good Shepherd, he's the best mate we've known." I think the UAV version, the AUV version should be the AA version. Because I think the way that Lee wrestled with that passage did what John's Gospel invites us to do. It invites us into a dialogue. And whatever comes out of that dialogue is authentic. So thank you, Lee, for the Australian authentic version, one version of the Australian authentic version. We'll all have our own, but that was great. Anyway, I gave up, but I picked out some key elements to look at. And I think, as I've just said, this is the best way to reflect on John's gospel. It's unlike the other gospels that tell a particular story to a particular primary audience in a particular context. John's gospel is a meditation. It's why it's different chronologically from all the others, because it picks up themes and elements and presents them almost as a communion with the divine. It's many-layered, and we can come back to it often and discover that it says old things in new ways. So let's ask some obvious questions, because the obvious questions often lead to some reflective answers. Who are the sheep? Well, the sheep are us. Andrew Pryor points out that sheep are a picture for the people of God, and not a particularly flattering one. As anyone familiar with sheep knows. John Petty says, I reckon we're mostly like Aussie sheep. I am. We're inclined to keep as far away from the farmer as we can. If a farmer tries to drive us through a gate to good feed, we won't go through. Or we'll be like the mob of sheep my dad and I had once. They ignored the open gate and the whole 200 hit the fence next to it flat out and got themselves tangled up and mangled in the wire and brought down 150 yards of fence. Not one of them wanted to go through the open gate. Well, this for me highlights the animal's vulnerability. Our vulnerability. We get rather exercised over the conditions of live exports because of this. Farmers too know the heartbreak of animals affected by drought. I've seen emotion well up at the prospect of having to shoot their animals. And there are only two reasons for raising sheep: wool and meat. Their destiny is clear. But I know no one in sheep and cattle that doesn't exercise an attachment and accountability for the care of the stock in which they are in charge. Now, this segues somewhat into the biblical model of animal husbandry. Vulnerability was accounted for by smaller mobs of sheep and shepherds to look after them. So there's more potential for that personal intimacy between the one who cares for the sheep and the sheep themselves in their weakness and vulnerability. So we can turn now to looking at who is the shepherd, especially the good shepherd that typically takes centre stage on the fourth Sunday of Easter. It's plain that the good shepherd knows his sheep personally, fosters and nurtures their welfare, puts himself in danger to protect them from harm. And we, the vulnerable sheep, will often project our own images on the shepherd, what's forming in our mind from our relationship, into whatever image appears, which is why often we get that Caucasian, gentle image of the shepherd. In other cultures, it would be other projections of what the shepherd would look like. Susan Guthrie reflects that Good Shepherd Sunday promises sentimental loveliness and nostalgia, but if you really look at the text, it also delivers some overwhelming challenges. She says, I think it's nearly impossible to meditate on Jesus' discourse of the Good Shepherd without also hearing Ezekiel 34 in the background. Waking up to the corruption of bad shepherds accountability in the causes of justice, and knowing the Holy One as shepherd. The Hebrew tradition, along with its surrounding ancient Middle Eastern cultures, had such a high regard for the figure of the shepherd that rulers and tribal leaders and kings described themselves as shepherds. Good rulers cared for their people. Bad rulers exploited them, took advantage of their vulnerability. It's no accident that the prophet Samuel, in seeking to exercise the Lord's direction to select a king for Israel, an iconic king, picked the runt of Jesse's brood, his otherwise fine strapping sons, and instead chose the forgotten one out in the paddock looking after the sheep. And so David becomes the well-known shepherd king. The shepherd figure becomes an archetype, an ancient one that becomes part of our collective memory and lives on into our contemporary society. The Penguin Dictionary of Symbols talks about the shepherd in this way. The symbolism of the shepherd also holds the sense of a wisdom which is both intuitive and the fruit of experience. The shepherd symbolises watchfulness. The shepherd's duties entail the constant exercise of vigilance. The shepherd is awake and watching. Hence the shepherd is compared with the sun, S-U-N, which sees all things, and with the king. Furthermore, since the shepherd symbolises the nomad, the shepherd is rootless and stands for the soul which is not a native of this earth, but always a stranger and a pilgrim. Insofar as the shepherd's flock is concerned, the shepherd acts as a guardian, and to this is linked knowledge, since the shepherd knows what pasture suits the animals in his charge. The shepherd sees the heavens, the sun, the moon, and the stars, and can predict the weather. The shepherd distinguishes sounds and hears the noise of approaching wolves, as well as the bleating of lost sheep. Through the different duties which the shepherd performs, he is regarded as a sage, as a wise one, whose activities are the result of contemplation and inner vision. This was the discovery of a retired actor, by the name of Miriam, I'll see if I can pronounce her name right, Margulies. You probably know her as Professor Sprout in the Harry Potter movies. And there's a Netflix program at the moment called Almost Australian. She's moved to Australia, became an Australian citizen, and set out to discover what it is that makes Australia a so-called lucky country. And in one episode, she comes across a farm in the outback of New South Wales, which has been struggling with drought for about 3 years. And as she gets to know the couple who run the farm and their two sons, it becomes very evident that the shepherding values are expressed in the way that they tell their story as they weep over the having to shoot drought-stricken cattle, and as they read the signs of the land and prepare for what may be ahead. This idea of the wisdom of the shepherd is evident in their approach. So I'm drawn now to reflect on the word good. It's a necessarily binary word, but is it necessary? We've already shown that bad shepherds are not shepherds at all. Either hirelings that have no interest in the welfare of the sheep, or thieves and robbers, or those who want to take advantage of the sheep's vulnerability. Surely this disqualifies them from being named as shepherds. The only real shepherds are good ones. So is the word good redundant? Well, William Temple steps up to the plate. He says this: the good one, the shepherd, the beautiful one. It's important that the word for good here is one that stands for not the moral rectitude of goodness, nor its austerity, but its attractiveness. We must not forget that our vocation is so to practice virtue that people are won to it. It is possible to be morally upright repulsively. In the Lord Jesus, we see the beauty of holiness. He was good in such a manner as to draw all people to himself. And this beauty of goodness is supremely seen in the act by which he would so draw them, wherein he lays down his life for the sheep. The close link of this passage to reminiscences that take place on Anzac Day is worth pondering. The notion of those who lay down their lives for their friends, the greatest love, is magnetic. It's probably that mystical notion that draws out so many crowds on the Anzac Day commemorations. It's deemed good. There is something about the shepherd nature of Jesus that is attractive. Certainly his popularity is clear throughout his ministry. Beyond the crowd-pulling, miracle-working, his embodiment of the words that he spoke and taught were compelling and magnetic. We might imagine that the pinnacle of this example setting in his crucifixion and resurrection was underlined when he appeared in risen form amongst his disciples and his followers. The attractiveness, the compelling beauty of his fully realized human nature with a divinity now within reach for all describes an understated goodness, all epitomized in his own words, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends." And thus, in this recognition, we learn our true selves, our true names, in response to the calling voice of the Good Shepherd. John Petty's stupid and chaotic sheep that are unable to find the open gate lacked a recognisable shepherd voice calling them through. I remember a short visit to the Middle East, standing at a roadside where a flock of sheep was being separated for the night by about two or three shepherds. Each shepherd used a particular call, each one different, and the sheep responded and went with their particular shepherd to their night enclosure. Bruno Barnhart gives us something to think about when we think about what is the name by which we are being called forth by the Good Shepherd. Jesus, the new Adam, is at once shepherd and word, the name of God, who is sent to men and women to call them by name, by their true names in the creative word, which are godly names, generative of divine being. Those who hear the word of God are gathered into it and become gods with a little g themselves. Those who receive the Son of God are gathered into him and become children of God. The violent compulsion which leads Jesus' hearers to take up stones to kill him comes from beyond themselves, from one who would only kill and destroy. What they rush forward to destroy is the divine human life, which is their own destiny. "I have other sheep, there will be one flock, one shepherd. The Father and I are one." The sheepfold into which Jesus leads those who hear his voice, who hear him speak their new names, whether they have been Jews or Gentiles, is ultimately this one, this I am, which is his own being. So we've reflected so far on the nature of the sheep, the nature of the shepherd archetype, the beauty and the attractiveness of the shepherd, and the discovery of our true nature in him. Well might we dwell on these reflections. John's gospel is many-layered and leads us deeper into that beatific experience of union with the crucified and risen one. to the extent that it almost takes our breath away. The danger is that, like Peter on the Mountain of Transfiguration, we want to build booths and stay there, stay camped on the mountaintop, when the mission beckons from the valley. We have yet to reflect on when Jesus also declares, "I am the gate." Take notice when Jesus, particularly in John's Gospel, uses the words, "I am." Because he not only says, "I am the good shepherd," he also says in our passage, "I am the gate." Why a gatekeeper? Paul Nochtelein asks the question. Isn't that a bit formal for the average sheep herd? Marty Aiken mentioned to me last night after the service that he's not a city boy. This is Paul Nochtelein speaking. And he said that the only time he can think of when there might be a gatekeeper for the sheep is when they are brought to the stockyard to be slaughtered. This is the point, in fact, where the shepherd finally leaves his sheep for good, or for ill, if you're a sheep. The shepherd does not enter the stockyard with his sheep. He abandons them to the slaughter. He's worse than the hired man, in fact, for he was the one we followed and trusted with our lives. It was similar in Jesus' day. There wasn't a gatekeeper at the average sheep pen, but I'll bet there was a gatekeeper at the big sheep gate in Jerusalem, where the sheep would be led to the great Passover slaughter every year. And this is where the average shepherd would leave his sheep off at the gate, abandoning them to the slaughter. But Jesus is the good shepherd who walks right through that gate with the sheep and goes ahead of them, out the other side of the holding pen, into the temple courtyard to be slaughtered. So Jesus isn't just laying down his life out in the field for some dangerous wolf. The most dangerous place for a sheep in Jesus' day was out in the temple courtyard. The wolves are already a metaphor for the sacrificers who come to slaughter the lambs in the sacrificial machinery. Jesus lays down his life as the Lamb of God on the altar of sacrifice. Bill Bailey also notes that in John chapter 5, Jesus met the paralytic whom he cured on the Sabbath, where? At the pool near the sheep gate, which is the gate in the wall of Jerusalem through which the sheep were led and then held in a holding area on their way to the altar of sacrifice. It was the entry point for the victims of the sacrificial regime. This reminds me of the farmer's birthday. The chicken and the pig were deciding what to give him. The chicken says to the pig, "Let's make him breakfast. I'll supply the eggs, you supply the bacon." Now, pigs are intelligent creatures. The pig replied, "No way. You're only donating while demanding my total commitment." The good shepherd, in laying down his life, is totally committed. He's totally committed to those who hear his voice. Andrew Pryor reminds us that Jesus does not keep us away from the killing floor, but goes before us and with us. His dying sets us free and takes us toward abundant life. We are free from sacrifice. We are free from the constant crippling fear of being chosen as the scapegoat, which means we fight always to be at the top and the front and to call the shots. Our paralyzed humanity is healed. And as a final word, I offer a reflection from Steve Garner's Holmes. It's nice to think of being personally shepherded by Jesus, but it's not all about our own smug comfort in green pastures. Jesus doesn't call us just for our sake. It's to follow him, going somewhere, from town to town, healing, proclaiming grace, People certainly gained benefits from being among the early Jesus followers. But they also worked, prayed, and shared with each other for the sake of the community. Jesus isn't trying to shepherd us to heaven. He's shepherding us into the world to serve with love. It's also tempting to believe that in Jesus' care, we'll meet no pain, difficulty, or loss. The calm, idyllic, pastoral 23rd Psalm leads us right out of green pastures into the valley of the shadow of death. Good Shepherd Jesus doesn't promise ease and comfort. He promises his loving presence even in awful times. Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. To follow Jesus is to take up a cross, not a lawn chair. Jesus' image of the Good Shepherd is one of mutual intimacy. The shepherd calls his sheep by name, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. He knows them personally by name. Jesus encourages us to believe in a God who knows us, who understands us, and believes in us, who doesn't just react to us according to the formula of laws and requirements. And the sheep know him well enough to recognize his voice. The point of our faith is not to believe some stuff about Jesus, but to know him like a friend, to engage in a living relationship. I think that's what it means when he says, "I am the gate. Whoever enters by me will be saved and will come in and go out and find pasture." In our relationship with Jesus, we enter into a place of rest and belonging, of nurture and empowerment. And we follow him and we know him well enough to listen to him. May God be with you as you work out how the Good Shepherd is addressing your living, individually and together. Amen. Yeah, Q&A?
Hi, thanks for that. You used the phrase scapegoat fairly late on in your... And that got me thinking, well, what about the goats? Because we have that idea of the sheep and the goats being sort of the good and the bad or something like that. Have you got any thoughts, opinions on that at all?
Yeah, the scapegoat is something that comes up a lot in Gil Bailey's what he calls mimetic theory, in that society survives by looking for someone that it can blame when someone goes wrong. So, and in the Old Testament, you had the picture of the goat being chosen. I think it was linked with the Day of Atonement, when the community was absolved of its sin. All the sins of the people would be laid on a goat, and it would be sent off into the wilderness to fend for itself. And so that's where the idea of the scapegoat comes from. And you'll notice it today that, if someone blots their copybook, the community tends to, the unbleached community tends to turn on them and project a lot of their stuff onto them, so that what they've actually done looms up into something very big. And, community has things in place that will, through courts and through systems, sometimes not even through the courts, but through summary execution, to say, okay, we've dealt with that problem now. It's really society's problem, but they've laid it all on that person and they become the scapegoat. And Gil Bailey's contention is that this is what happened with Jesus, that he became the scapegoat for all the projections of the ruling, the religious establishment. And that's, if we understand the cross, the crucifixion, through that element, and if we understand his resurrection as a way of saying the end of scapegoatism, because, the cross and the resurrection is God's way of dealing with this tendency within human society.
I'd just like to further comment on that you just made me think that scapegoats are often the people who are a little bit different. The people who go along with the flow, like the sheep, tend to be ignored, whereas the goats are often the ones that do something different, and therefore, as you say, all ills are put on them. We saw a very interesting illustration of that when we were in Israel. 30 of us piled out of a bus, and there was a flock of sheep with a few goats amongst them on the side of the road there with their shepherd, and the sheep quite alarmed. So the shepherd called them and sort of walked away up the hill, and the sheep followed. But the goats stayed there because they were busy ripping apart a tree or doing something or other. And the shepherd had to call them several times. And we laughed. We said, look, the sheep just do as they're told and follow, and the goats, they're being naughty, as goats usually do, are.
Gives us a new understanding of Matthew 25, doesn't it?
I just want to stand up for the dogs. Where were the dogs in the Australian story? So it's not the farmer who tells the sheep where to go, it's the dogs who round them up. And having a sister who's a farmer, they had marimas, and the marimas have got rid of the need for unhelpful sheep hands, because no fox or is going to take on a marima. And I can't really weave that into the story, if one attempted to, perhaps that the dogs represent the world of nature as well. And it's a bit of a side thing, but I kept thinking about the dogs.
No, worth reflecting on. As I say, John's Gospel opens up many layers and can take us all sorts of directions. Foot Rot Flats comes to mind. And dog doesn't even have a name, he's just dog. But you look at the relationship of the of dog with, I forget who his owner is. Wall, that's right. And, it's really quite special, isn't it?
I have a problem. The shepherd leads the sheep. And I see, as Trish said, I've seen the relationship between the shepherd and the sheep. And it's very close.
It's an oblique reference, and it conflicts with our other picture of the gate, where it's often said that the sheep were herded into an open fold at night time, and the shepherd would lay down across the opening. Would literally lay down and sleep across the opening to, and anything that was trying to get at the sheep would first have to get past the shepherd. So that's another illustration.
Yes.
You're right. You've got to think, this does disturb me somewhat. But when you look at the whole context of John's Gospel, it's about how Jesus, did eventually lay down his life, and that the Word that became flesh had the ultimate say in the resurrection. This was what used to happen with shepherds and sheep when the Passover festival was near. It was a real bloodbath when the Passover feast was on, because all these families had to buy a sheep, usually, a lamb, really, so it's a new sheep. And you've got this vision of this whole abattoir just outside the temple. Yeah. So it was a very powerful image when Jesus, said, "Well, I give my life, the Last Supper," where he's virtually demonstrating how he himself is going to become the Passover lamb.
You've probably just said it, but I just want to say thank you for introducing that conflict, because I think one of the reasons that kids leave churches when they get to an age where they're thinking well for themselves is those conflicts don't marry up with their Sunday school, cuddly Jesus, who, the lamb around the shoulders thing. And for me, I think that the moment of my death is not going to be because God is absent, but the moment of my death will be a fulfillment of the presence of God. And it might be that I'll be really snarly and not want to die, but God will be there in the midst of my whatever it is. Thanks for that.
Precisely. Thank you. That's good. I hope we're going away with more questions than answers.